thank first Stan Osher and Mark Green for letting us organize this very exciting workshop, as you're going to see. And on behalf of Jim, Jerry, myself, and Leon and myself, I'd like, of course, to thank you for coming here. I'll chair the first session, but we're going to rotate with the other organizers. And this, the way we made this workshop, all four of us, is that so that we cover all areas of cardiac analysis, mechanics, physiology, etc. So we have a mixture of clinicians slash technical people, but I think we're going to give you the whole picture of what's going on with the heart and what's the state of the art these days. We're going to start with the first session, and this is more like an overview session about clinical issues. And the first speaker is going to be Dr. Ajay, who has, of course, a very good career on clinical and technical work, followed by Dr. Axel. So I would like to give the floor to Dr.
Thanks very much. Good morning. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. I think my charge is to offer you the perspective of a clinician on the current situation in cardiac imaging, both its successes and some of its egregious failures, and set the stage for many of the speakers to come to offer potential solutions to some of these problems. I am very much a clinician. I've practiced cardiology for about 30 years, and I've had the good or bad fortune to be involved in so-called non-invasive cardiac imaging from its inception, and had the opportunity to work with all of the technologies currently in clinical use over an extended time span. I have some very mixed messages to offer you this morning because, as I said, there are some considerable successes and there also are some very serious deficiencies in the current state of cardiac imaging as it's used by the clinician. I won't dwell on who the epistemologist is who I found this construct from, but you may recognize it. But really, a lot of what I have to say could be subdivided into what cardiologists think they know, what they know they don't know, and what they don't know they don't know. I'd like to show you how that may play out in the real world. If you look at the clinical cardiovascular literature, about 80 to 90% of it can be boiled down to bad is worse than good. That is to say, people looking in a univariate sense at a single variable that differs among the healthy and the sick, and setting out to subdivide that population by some parameter, whether it's an outcome parameter or some functional parameter, and showing triumphantly that indeed bad is worse than good. And the reason for this fairly primitive approach to information really rests with the difficulties of making choices in the clinical world and testing the validity of those choices. The effort always is to look for some kind of binary treatment rule, and if X exceeds value N, then one does thus and so. And the reason for it is because proof of efficacy in the real world is extraordinarily hard to get to. And if you look at the kinds of clinical trials that have been required to demonstrate relatively simple things, for example, that administering a clockbuster drug to somebody who has a thrombus in a coronary artery will be beneficial in terms of outcomes, there are such trials that involved up to 30,000 subjects and took enormous amounts of money to perform. There are only so many of these one can do. And the ability then to look in a more nuanced way at the variables that determine that is often quite limited in the clinical world. So the general form of these treatment rules is that if X has a certain value, then the treatment is Y. And there are many, many examples of this. For example, in the treatment of high blood pressure, X is simply systolic blood pressure, and then there's an array of recommended antihypertensive drugs. In the setting of lipid disorders, elevated cholesterol, the variable of interest is usually the LDL cholesterol. And again, there are very simple rules as to at what levels of cholesterol one would intervene. Rules, however, which keep changing over time as it becomes more and more apparent that bad is worse than good. The same applies to a number of areas that are of particular interest currently. One of them is defibrillator implantation. These devices which detect potentially lethal arrhythmias and automatically discharge to keep the patient alive. And the second is probably the largest preoccupation of the clinical cardiologist, which is the treatment of patients with stenotic coronary arteries, in which the two treatment choices are insertion of stents or coronary bypass surgery, and for which X is the percent diameter of a coronary artery. I won't have much time to spend on that, but that's an area, too, where there are some very serious deficiencies in the way one goes about this. A lot of the examples are really based on imaging, and here are a few of them. For a long time, the administration of ACE inhibitors and beta blockers has been rooted in part on the value of left ventricular ejection fraction, or the percent of the blood in the left ventricular cavity that is pumped into the aorta on every heartbeat. For stents and CABGs, we've mentioned the percent coronary artery stenosis. And increasingly in recent years, for implantable defibrillators, simple determination of the left ventricular ejection fraction. These rules, of course, don't look critically at a lot of considerations in the intermediary physiology of this system because, in fact, ejection fraction is not a single number in a biologic sense, but a range of numbers depending on the ambient loading conditions at any instant in time. Now, what cardiologists know they don't know is how to get stable data that's reliable in a single patient to use in this kind of an approach to treatment rules. And that may seem paradoxical, but it is a constant subject of conversation in the halls of my hospital every day. The clinicians that my group provides imaging information for are continually distressed by the lack of concordance of a series of measurements over time, the lack of concordance between information acquired from different kinds of imaging, and the difficulties of seeing a clear and instructive pattern in some of the information. The causes of this are, of course, multiple. One is the biologic variability that I referred to earlier, because, in fact, any ejection measure in the heart is, in fact, extremely load dependent and therefore will vary over time with the volume of blood in the chambers, with the heart rate, and with a number of other determinants of ejection fraction. The second major problem, which I'm going to spend some time on, is measurement variability. And this, I regret to say, is an enormous problem in the clinical arena. It's one that perhaps solutions for can emerge from the efforts of a group like this. And the last is inadequate data sampling. That is to say, the heart's a three-dimensional object that is continually deforming, and to capture that deformation in a clinical environment and reduce the data in a way that's useful is a very complex task, and therefore most clinical decision making is based on very simplistic approaches to sampling even the simple geometric data on the heart. And as you'll see, these approaches often fail exactly when you need them the most. So, what are the measurement problems? Well, first of all, you have to measure X in vivo in a human being. This is no simple task, and we've learned the hard way over and over and over again that things that look very good in phantoms, in other kinds of in vitro models, and indeed in small and moderately large animals, turn out not to work as well in humans. So the validation of a measurement you propose to apply in the clinical setting then becomes a challenging exercise because it has to be validated in humans. So you need a gold standard. This can be very hard to come by. If you think about imaging, say, the left ventricle, there is no hard physical objective gold standard for the volume of the blood in the left ventricle. There are a variety of methods of estimating it, but to use any one of them as the reference technique is rather simplistic. And indeed, if you want a hard measurement standard, I'm going to say that the only one really available is one that I'm afraid I've had to use more than once, which is the actual weight of the left ventricular myocardium in a patient imaged while alive in whom the weight is determined after death. And if one looks critically at the other reference methods used, none of them, in fact, are hard physical measurements in that sense. Furthermore, because of measurement variability, one always has to factor in that variability as a component in the estimate, and that can be very disabling at times, as I'll show you. And all too often, this problem of measurement accuracy and variability is critical and all too often unknown. And indeed, one of the reasons it's frequently unknown is that you need to determine the performance characteristics of these measurements in the population that is to be studied, so that things that appear to work quite satisfactorily in relatively healthy populations, for example, fail over and over and over again in the sick. And the more complex the architecture and function of the heart is, the more likely is that failure. So, what's the gold standard? These are the questions that come up all the time. What's the accuracy and reproducibility of the proposed in vivo technique? How good is the validation? And does the measurement perform well in the population to be studied? These are critical questions, and if one surveyed the literature using cardiac imaging, you would find that they are rarely answered. Right now, I think most cardiologists would be willing to accept the premise that cardiac MRI is, for now, the functional gold standard. And this is just a set of cine loops in the short axis plane of a normal human volunteer, ranging from the very tip of the very tip of the left ventricle up through both the left and right ventricles to the level of the atria, aorta, and pulmonary artery, and on through the back of the left atrium to the descending aorta. So this is a volumetric study of the human heart. Nowadays, you can accomplish this in about 10 to 15 minutes. But then you have to process the data. And the way we process the data currently is excruciatingly manual. So these are a set of outlines of the endocardium and epicardium in this heart, traced by someone in my lab who does nothing else. That's the current state of the common levels of data reduction in this proposed reference method. The big advantage of it is with this kind of volumetric imaging, you can improve the reducibility, and this is a very powerful step. The common technique for looking at left ventricular volumes and ejection fraction is a technique called two-dimensional echocardiography, which simply looks at a few planes through the left ventricle over the cardiac cycle, and from which one can use geometric models to make estimates of the volume and emptying of the left ventricle, or, as is common in clinical laboratories, the, quote, experienced observer, unquote, eyeballs the data and makes a best guess as to what that value is. as you might expect, the agreement among experienced observers is not terribly good. But actually, the news is much worse than that. But this is what happens when one looks at reproducibility, and this is from some work by Dudley Pennell's group at the Royal Brompton. The variability of the measure is about a third to a sixth with MR of what it is with the common clinical tool, two-dimensional echocardiography. This has enormous consequences. For example, the physician seeing a patient recurrently over time often needs to make decisions based on whether or not left ventricular performance has changed. If you have an extremely variable measure of left ventricular performance, such as echocardiography, the magnitude of the change that you can take to be real in a given individual patient is really quite large. And in fact, it's outside of the biologic range of that variation with disease over short periods of time. In contrast, with an improved imaging method and a volumetric approach to the problem, one gets down to changes that are within the range one might well encounter over time in a given individual. This has an enormous impact because continually clinicians seeing a patient over time are faced with important and even pivotal decisions. Does the patient go for valve replacement surgery? Does the patient who has coronary disease and has had several myocardial infarctions need to be considered for actual surgical revision of the left ventricle? These are the kind of choices that are at issue on this kind of frail data. It also has enormous consequences for the investigator because the sample size you need to detect any given level of change is a function of the square of that variability. And the result is that with MR, for say these relatively modest but realistic changes in such a given variable, for example, if one wanted to look at whether a given antihypertensive treatment led to a regression of hypertrophy of the left ventricle, this is the number of patients one might actually need given those variability values for CMR. But with the usual clinical methods, such as echo, the size of that sample is much larger. Here's a specific example of this, a study I did a few years ago with Bert Pitt when a new anti-aldosterone agent, enalapril, was coming to the fore, in which we sought to look at the effects of this, since aldosterone is a potent contributor to the cascade that leads to hypertrophy of the myocardium in hypertension. And we sought to look at three active treatment regimens, one using a eplerenone with adjunctive treatment, one using an ACE inhibitor, enalapril, and one using the combination. And with fairly modest sample sizes, we're able to demonstrate that all three active treatment legs, it would be unethical to have a placebo control in a hypertension treatment study in these days, that each of them produced a significant drop in left ventricular mass, and furthermore, that one could distinguish between the greater effects of the combined regimen and the effects of eplerenone alone. If one tried to do this with the usual echocardiographic measures that are common, you would need about 1,800 patients rather than 150 because of the high variability of the technique. The impact of this is really quite enormous, certainly on drug development, and the pharmaceutical industry has begun to recognize this, and indeed we now run core labs for MRI-based studies for a number of new agents. And in addition, it affects experimental work in the university as well. For example, if one is looking at models of myocardial infarction and seeking to determine the contribution of various cytokines to that and the effects of various therapeutic perturbations in such an infarct model, one can do that kind of work in much smaller numbers of experiments with these kinds of methods. But the story gets worse. This is actually a paper that has a very sad history. I'm afraid, though the authors, I hope, don't know it to this day, that I followed it down the food chain of peer review quite a number of levels. The data in it was enormously important, but it wasn't a very good manuscript. And so it ultimately found its level in the food chain, if you will, but unfortunately the data has really been overlooked since then. This was a study from the Mayo Clinic, which has a superb echocardiography laboratory that has contributed a lot to the field, which was then collaborating with John Rumberger, who was one of the early users of CT to look at cardiac structure and function, coming out of the University of Iowa's Cardiovascular Center. And in this study, they looked at a variety of types of patients, seeking to determine which of the echocardiographic methods was the most effective for making quantitative estimates of left ventricular size and function. They looked at a mix of patients, some of whom had dilated cardiomyopathy, some of whom had valvular heart disease, and some of whom had prior myocardial infarction. And while the agreement between the best of the echo methods and a volumetric CT approach, which is very comparable to MR in many respects in terms of what it can do in terms of volumetric imaging, was reasonably good and acceptable for these variables in the cardiomyopathy and valvular heart disease group. In the patients with myocardial infarction, the concordance between the two techniques broke down. These kinds of statistics for a regression coefficient and variability are well outside the range that one would ordinarily accept for a clinical test, so that less than 50% of the variation is actually captured by the two-dimensional echo measurement. And yet I can tell you that across the US and Europe, decisions are made in millions of patients with coronary artery disease based on echocardiographic findings. Not a trivial issue. It was a particularly painful one to recognize for me because I had devoted considerable effort in earlier years to contributing to the echocardiographic literature on quantitation, doing what we thought were as rigorous approaches as we could devise at the time, including some that used postmortem left ventricular mass in patients as the reference method. And yet here was evidence that in the population of real interest, these methods really didn't work very well at all. So we began to look into this, and first, since we were doing some work on left ventricular remodeling after infarction, we simply did some retrospective examinations of our own data in patients with recent myocardial infarction. And we looked at the echocardiographic data, both as interpreted by the skilled eyeball, if you will, and by the quantitative methods that had proved the most robust in that Mayo paper I showed you. This is the observer data. As you can see, there's very poor agreement between the echo method and MR. And the two observers agreed closely. It showed that we had indeed entrained each other in this laboratory, and I was one of the readers, but we had not managed to capture the real information content of the images. Furthermore, the quantitative method did no better, which was a rather disturbing observation, and was really quite concordant with the results from Mayo that I showed you with CT instead of MR as the reference technique. If one looked in a binary sense at a decision rule, the error rates were substantial. 25 to 30 some odd percent of patients were miscategorized for any binary cutoff using the common clinical technique. Well, that was retrospective data, so we did a prospective study, which I regret to say was underfunded and never completed as an outcome study. This is about half the data acquired. Leon Axel was kind enough to do the MR analyses for this. We needed close to 200 patients to look at a determination of whether better stratification of ventricular properties would lead to better prediction of risk and outcome, and we never got more than about 70. But these data are quite representative. This is the quantitative echo method, and here MR in patients with recent myocardial infarction. all of whom were supposed to have a clinical test that indicated an ejection fraction of less than 40%, since that's the population who are believed to be at risk of death and other major negative outcomes. As you can see, they weren't all less than 40% by the echo method or by MR, and indeed quite a number of them were actually normal by MR. Once again, if you plug that into a binary treatment rule, you will make a mistake in decision making in on the order of a third to 40% of patients. This is not good news. These are very large decisions that have weighty effects on the survival of patients, have enormous consequences for the delivery of healthcare. And the ante has actually been upped recently by the defibrillator story. The key study with regard to this is something called the MADIT 2 study, which after a period of time in which electrophysiologists in the clinical domain had used a variety of invasive testing to decide who might be at risk for sudden death or recurrent potentially lethal ventricular tachycardia, the focus had turned to reduced ejection fraction. And in this study, stratifying patients by any clinical test for EF of 30% or less, they were able to demonstrate a significant reduction in mortality with defibrillator implantation. Well, having had the experience we'd already had with this question of ejection fraction, we knew that there was reason to think that this might not be the end of the story. The implications are really quite enormous. These devices cost about $30,000, up to $30,000 a piece. The implantation costs around $10,000. The patient has to be followed carefully. There are many problems with the devices, as some of you will have read about the Guidant Corporation, for example, in recent months. The population at risk is enormous. It's thought that this rule would lead to a tripling of ICD implantations. And yet the proponents argued that the cost effectiveness appeared to be comparable to that for the treatment of high blood pressure, and better than that of so-called ACE inhibitors administered for left ventricular dysfunction. So the question then becomes, is the error rate here similar to that we've previously shown? And would the use of a better imaging technique improve risk stratification? In a nutshell, these are the binary classification error rates we found with the clinical test being used at our institution. By now, we've enrolled probably 60 to 65 patients in this study, but I'll show you the data on the first 50 or so. Here is the CMR ejection fraction, and here's the clinical ejection fraction. As you can see, R squared is only 0.15. These are the Bland-Altman limits of agreement, which are extremely wide. It doesn't matter if you're using echocardiography whether you use a quantitative method or not, because the results with the quantitative method are just as bad. And indeed, if one looks at the relationship to indices of a bad outcome, in the short term we had to use mainly whether the patient had an inducible ventricular arrhythmia, the clinical ejection fraction within the population really did not discriminate between those with and without arrhythmias. But within the population, the CMR ejection fraction, volumetric indices of the left ventricle normalized to body size, and a bit surprisingly, the ratio of left ventricular mass to volume, as well as the left ventricular mass normalized to as well as the percent of the ventricle infarcted with the delayed enhancement technique, appeared to have more information content. And if one did an ROC type analysis, these were the results we came up with, and these are the ROC curves for the volume indices for the left ventricle and for the MR and clinical ejection fractions. So why is the echo technique so bad? Well, the main reason is that it was never really validated in the population being studied. it can't capture the complexity of three-dimensional shape and dynamic changes in size and shape in a population with advanced coronary artery disease. This validation work was largely done in the late 1970s, and as someone who was practicing cardiology then, I can tell you that the population it's now being applied to did not survive in those days. So there wasn't a large population akin to the one treated now. The basic problem relates really to left ventricular asymmetry. And that problem now gets worse because increasingly the emphasis is on new strategies for treatment, not only in those with the most asymmetry, but in those with the most asynchrony of contraction of different portions of the left ventricle, so that techniques for so-called biventricular pacing to improve the synchrony of contraction of different parts of these hearts has become a very key component of therapy now. And in that enterprise, the temporal heterogeneity of contraction becomes even more important than the absolute level of performance. There is some better news. There are some older techniques that seem to do a bit better, although this was, and this was from that same prospective study I mentioned before, in which you'll recall the MR ejection fractions ranged up to 60-70% in patients who supposedly had EFs under 40%. This is the planar multiple gated radionuclide ventriculogram. The R values around 0.7 or so. That's better. It's not very good. And then there's invasive ventriculography. Now, for many clinicians, this is the gold standard. You take the patient to the catheterization lab, usually to do a coronary angiogram primarily, but while you're there, you power inject 50 ml of iodinated contrast into the left ventricle, and you take a single projection image over the course of the cardiac cycle, a so-called right oblique ventriculogram. Now, given what I've shown you, there's every reason to think that this would be a dismal way of assessing ventricular performance in this population. But when we looked at it, surprisingly, the results were better than expected, again, over a broader range of the variables than I showed you in these earlier studies. When we looked at, again, there are two means. There is still the skilled eyeball, and then there is a so-called area length method, which treats the left ventricle as a solid of revolution, exactly the wrong thing to do in these kinds of parts, obviously. But nonetheless, that gives reasonably useful results and that shows a relation to CMR volumetric EF that falls along the line of identity with a modest bias and reasonably acceptable Bland-Altman limits. In contrast, the skilled eyeball does considerably worse. And if one looks in terms of binary classification rules, the observer will make an error one time out of four, but the area length technique actually didn't misclassify any patients in this series. I'm sure if it were a little larger, that would not have held out, but still it was surprisingly good. And these are the actual values shown. There are other techniques that look promising. Three-dimensional echocardiography has come a long way, although it still has a long way to go in terms of spatial and temporal resolution. Nonetheless, Asha Gopal in our lab has been working in this area for over a decade and is showing increasingly good results. Here are some of them with an offline reconstruction technique. We're now looking at real-time 3D imaging, and we have comparable data in terms of performance with real-time imaging. And here, the relationship to CMR is considerably better. The data fall close to the line of identity. The biases are small, and the limits are reasonably acceptable, although not as good as one might like. There is a tomographic version of the radionuclide ventriculogram that also looks promising. There is a technique for gated wall motion after injection of cestamibi, which is taken up by live myocytes. And that works very well in better hearts, but in the kind of hearts we're talking about, with large infarcts, it breaks down because there is no uptake in the infarct region, so you can't see the wall. Multi-detector CT has some real promise, but right now has low temporal resolution, really too low for the kinds of problems we've been talking about. And there tends to be an underestimation of EF, probably because of the temporal resolution problem that needs to be solved. There are reasons to hope that as further technologic advances occur, that the temporal resolution of CT is going to improve and that these limitations can be addressed. But then, who says that MR is a gold standard? As I've said, the in vivo validations aren't much use. The physical reference method for looking at the weight of the left ventricle has been done in animal models, but actually can't be done in patients these days. I know, I've tried. And the reason for it is the only population in which you could do it is in patients receiving cardiac transplant in whom one did an MR evaluation before the heart was explanted and then got the physical measurements shortly thereafter. And there are no centers doing a sufficient number of these to make that a doable project at the present time. I won't belabor this. But let me point out to you some limitations of the current versions of use of CMR that need to be addressed. There can be misregistration due to the fact that data is acquired on multiple breath holds, and you're making the assumption that diaphragmatic position and the volume of air in the lungs is the same. The temporal resolution is still too low, although it actually can be pushed considerably above what's commonly used clinically, and that problem should abate, particularly with more use of parallel imaging. The ideal technique would be the breath hold 3D technique with MR, which is doable, but right now doable only with rather low temporal and spatial resolution compared to other techniques. The slice thickness is too great, and this may not be so amenable to solution because the fact is that the abundance of what you're looking at may not be sufficient in terms of the signal generated to get down to the kind of slice thicknesses one would like ideally, which is certainly at maximum. And the other thing is the time constraint. The maximum would be 5 millimeters and quite possibly less than that to really, really get a good depiction of the geometry. And the valve planes have ambiguous locations in these short axis images. That's a major constraint. One needs to use the long axis information too to see the valve plane better. Alistair Young may talk some about that, since his group in Auckland has done some nice work in that area that I think is just ready to emerge into the clinical arena. The image segmentation is an enormous problem. There's real operator variability. It hasn't yet been reliably automated in a way that's consistent across the quality of clinical images. There's a lack of relevant normal values, and I'll show you a little bit more of what I mean by that. Because it turns out that the concept of normal is subject to quite a number of intermediary variables in individual subjects. And lastly, the image analysis under present conditions is too costly and too slow. And we do it day in and day out on all of our clinical referrals, but it's a very low volume operation compared to the demand for cardiac imaging. And one simply can't spend the kind of resources it takes in the real world to answer common questions in a large number of patients with the existing techniques. There's hope that that's going to change. There's certainly continuing progress ongoing, but it's not solved yet. Here's an example of the inter-observer variability problem from the early days of our group, which I started this program at St. Francis about 4 years ago now. And we looked at three pairs of observers. And as you can see, the slope of the relationship varies by about 10 or 11%. The limits of agreement in the early days of training were relatively wide. We've gotten better than this. You can tighten this up considerably by looking at it recurrently. But it's not a trivial issue in the clinical arena. Now, the other thing that most labs don't have are real normal values. We began obtaining some, and here are some of the early ones But we've now got over 250 carefully screened real normals, no obesity, no hypertension, real normals screened also with other imaging techniques. But as we look at this population, we begin to see that what's normal depends on age, gender, body size, body mass index, a measure of obesity, the lean body mass, and blood pressure. So that identifying what's normal as it relates to a single individual who's not well really becomes a rather complex enterprise and requires the kind of size of databases that we don't have clinically available at this time. What can be done for CMR? Well, better breath hold 3D imaging would be immensely helpful. More use of parallel imaging to increase the rate at which you take data and improve temporal and hopefully spatial resolution. The combination of using multi-planar data for a single 3D model of the left ventricle, automated image segmentation, modeling to address data limits, and multivariate analyses to identify and generate relevant normal values. Now, what do cardiologists not know they don't know? Well, they don't know much about the myocardium when you get right down to it in a mechanical sense. They don't really appreciate the need to evaluate not only chamber function, but myocardial function. They tend not to appreciate that myocardial deformation is remarkably complex and has a complex relationship to fiber deformation as well. They tend not to appreciate the role in determining chamber function of myocardial volume and the ratio of myocardial volume to chamber volume. They have little information available to them about myocardial composition. And in many respects, understanding myocardial deformation in the diseased heart especially really depends to a good degree on being able to distinguish between myocytes, interstitium, and the vascular compartments and their contribution to myocardial deformation. And lastly, there's a lack of relevant information about the material properties of both normal and abnormal components of the myocardium to support such an effort. The concept that myocardial and chamber function were importantly different entered the clinical literature relatively late. The first time the point was made to a large clinical audience was really this paper from a Japanese group working with Bill Gash in the early 90s using angiographic data and demonstrating something the experimentalists knew well, which is that in hypertrophied hearts, myocardial function is depressed while chamber function remains normal. In the days when Leon and I were together at Penn, were able to show using the tagging technique that this could be readily demonstrated non-invasively in hypertensive subjects. Here's an example of some of the simple 1D data we used for that, and while the methods were primitive for the data reduction at the time, the observation, I think, holds largely correct that in patients with LVH, the circumferential strain is considerably lower than it is in normals with a comparable ejection fraction. Tagging has played an important role in this. This is an elegant example. This is a mouse heart beating at about 500 a minute from some images lent to me by Fred Epstein at the University of Virginia, and brings out the point both that the tagging technique enables one to track fixed points within the myocardium, but also that this is a scalable enterprise, and that it really therefore has immense utility in both research and in potentially in clinical medicine. For those of you who have not seen the tagging technique before, it's basically a saturation effect deposited in diastole, and by imaging recurrently during the cardiac cycle, one can then track the deformation of the grid. Leon added enormously to the progress in this area in the early days by doing a thought experiment as he walked across the South Street Bridge on his way to work one morning and figured out that one could really wrap this through three-dimensional space, and arrived at the scanner saying, I think I've got a better way. This is some of the primitive 1D analysis we did in the early days, now 2, and as Alistair, I'm sure, will show you, and Jerry Prince, 3D analysis is readily doable with a variety of techniques. The work from Jerry Prince and Neil Osman on the HARP technique, which uses phase changes in the tag distribution to extract the deformation data, has really been an important step forward. These images were kindly lent to me by Niall Osman and Shreya Lima. And the HARP technique is the first technique really viable for applying this in a large-scale way. Witnessed the use in the so-called MESA study, a very large-scale epidemiologic study on cardiovascular risk due to atherosclerosis, where it's been applied, I think, to about 1,000 subjects and shown some very, very interesting observations on subclinical abnormalities in patients one wouldn't label as diseased ordinarily. There's been validation work comparing it to the conventional measures from TAG, which shows okay concordance between the two methods. And it's become increasingly fast, such that it now promises to be applicable during stress testing, for example, with a little more work. There is some interesting data on that. There was one earlier paper from Hopkins in an experimental model showing the same fact that one can detect abnormalities in myocardial deformation that are more subtle with the tagging technique than with simple wall thickness analyses. And here's a clinical implementation of it using dobutamine MRI and comparing tagged and untagged data and demonstrating an increase in the detection rate for coronary artery stenoses. I think this is very promising, and some of the early work we did on the dobutamine stress using tagging techniques about a decade ago would lead me to suspect that in the long run it will be perfectly possible to use lower doses of stressors and detect myocardial dysfunction due to ischemia at a much earlier stage. Now, what about tissue properties? Well, some progress has been made. This is from a classic paper by Ray Kim and Bob Judd showing that the delayed enhancement technique can delineate myocardial scars very exactly as compared to the actual pathology of that scar. This is from experimental models, but the technique is now well validated in humans. It also turns out that patterns of macroscopic fibrosis of other causes are pretty well delineated. It doesn't address what goes on finely distributed in the interstitium with fibrosis, but it has nonetheless made a real contribution to our understanding of the tissue properties involved. There are some other steps that have been made in that area. We'll hear later in the week, I think, about the diffusion techniques for looking at fiber angle, for example, which is an important issue in diseased hearts. And there are some other new things looming. Recently, Jim Goldfarb, one of the MR physicists in our group, has discovered that in chronic infarcts, in addition to the fibrosis, there's a remarkable amount of fat in the infarct region, something that really hasn't been focused on in the past. We don't know how it gets there. We don't know what its implications are for the mechanics of the infarct region or the effects of the infarct region on the rest of the ventricle. And for that matter, we don't know its effects on a number of imaging techniques that we use to look at the infarct region in terms of its perfusion. But the problems still are extremely real in this domain. The imaging and the data reduction is limited in availability. It's too time consuming, it's too costly, can't be applied widely in a clinical sense right now. And furthermore, once you tame all those problems, you still need to look at deformation in the context of loading conditions. But really, this becomes very meaningful only if you know something about material properties and also about the unstressed dimensions of the heart, if you're looking for rigorous answers to some of the questions about cardiac mechanics. And these are elusive challenges that some very smart people have worked on for a considerable period of time. So, I'm sure more than used up my time, and where are we? Well, we've come to the problem of what modelers and imaging investigators think they know they don't know, and don't know they don't know, and I suspect in the rest of this week we'll hear quite a lot about that. Thank you very much for your attention.